From His Fullness, a Christmas sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin.
We who are utterly empty, with nothing in us but sin and corruption, we receive from Jesus, this child, everything that He is as both God and man. The fullness of deity dwells bodily in Him.
And we'll send you a CD of this sermon for any size, year-end, tax-deductible gift to Issues, etc. Make a secure online donation today, issuesetc.org. Thanks for thinking of us as we approach the end of 2009.
Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't suggest that Jesus was actually a divine person, although we usually read them as if they did say that. I think the reason people usually read them as if they said that is that they read them through the lens of the Gospel of John, which basically says that Jesus is God in person. And that's very radical. That's one thing I learned in this study, is that that message about Jesus being God in person is quite particular to the Gospel of John.
That's Elaine Pagels, author of the Gnostic Gospels. Her claim is that really only John's Gospel strays into the territory of claiming Jesus is divine, and that that notion is unsupported by the other eyewitness accounts, what she might allege to be alleged eyewitness accounts. She expresses what is not only scholarly opinion, if you will, also common opinion. You'll hear this in casual conversation. Well, Jesus never claimed to be God. Is that true? Well, of course, extraordinary claims call for extraordinary evidence, and the claims that historic Christianity has made about Jesus Christ are nothing if not extraordinary. God Himself in human flesh, a sacrificial death at the cross that pays for the sins of the whole world, and a resurrection from the dead, a bodily resurrection from the dead. And He's God, the Son of God. Those are extraordinary claims. Are they supported by the eyewitness evidence? Is it a rational claim to make that this man is God and was raised from the dead after paying the price for the sins of the world? We're going to talk about the deity of Christ during this first half hour of Issues Etc., live this Monday afternoon, December the 21st, I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. A little later in the program, we'll be teaching a Sunday school lesson with Deaconess Pam Nielsen of Concordia Publishing House today, of course, keeping with the season, or the season that quickly approaches, the birth of Jesus. Then a little later in the program on this Monday afternoon, Dr. Peter Scare will join us to explore in depth a theme that runs from the beginning to the end of the Bible, light, the theme of light in the Scriptures. Dr. Peter Scare of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Our call-in number for the next 2 hours, you can join us with questions or comments, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Email us with questions or comments right here in the studio, talkback at issuesetc.org, or you can always Twitter us at issuesetc. Dean Overman is our guest for the first half hour to talk about the deity of Christ. He's former senior partner of an international law firm. He was selected as Templeton Scholar for seminars in religion and science, and he's author of the new book titled A Case for the Divinity of Jesus, Examining the Earliest Evidence. Dean, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you.
According to the eyewitness accounts themselves, did Jesus regard Himself as divine?
Yes, I think you gave a quote from Elaine Pagels, and I think she has to reread the Synoptic Gospels if she thinks that Jesus' claims to be divine are only in the Gospel of John. In the Synoptic Gospels, what you have to do is look back to the name of God that appears in the situation where Moses is in the presence of a burning bush, and he receives a charge from God to go to Egypt and set the Israelites free. And God here identifies Himself as I am. So Moses says, if I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your ancestors has sent me, and they ask me, what is His name? What shall I say to them? And God says to Moses, I am who I am. Now, in the Septuagint, which was a Greek translation of the Old Testament, which was in existence at Jesus' time, the words I am were the words for the name of God. And those words in Greek are ego eimi, When Jesus is in the Gospel of Mark, before the high priest at his trial, the high priest asks him, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" And Jesus says, "I am, ego eimi, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven." And then the high priest tears his clothes and says, "Why do we still need witnesses? You've heard the blasphemy." Well, the reference to the high priest tearing his clothes demonstrates that Jesus' response was taken as a statement that he was divine, that he was saying, "I am ego eimi," in the sense that the Septuagint was describing when God spoke to Moses and said, "I am who I am." And what you see through the Synoptic Gospels, in addition to John, of course, where he frequently says, "I am, ego eimi," is that he says it in Matthew. He refers to himself when he's been walking on the water, when the disciples are afraid. He says, "Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid." But the Greek is actually very important here because he says, "Take heart, ego eimi, I am." These are words that the name of God was something extraordinarily sacred, so that the charge of blasphemy, which was why he was convicted and why he was sentenced to death, which was in the Gospel of Mark, also appears in statements in the Gospel of Matthew. You also have in Matthew statements where Jesus is at the very end of the gospel. He's saying the charge to go forth and baptize, and this is the last sentence of Matthew, "Baptize in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit." And then in Luke, another synoptic gospel that Elaine must reread, he says, "All things have been handed over to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father, or the Father who except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal him." So you have this situation where Jesus is using this language about himself, and he is also, in the Synoptics, accepting worship. In Matthew, when he's walking on the water, when he arrives in the boat, it's said, the Greek word is proskynine, and those in the boat worshipped him. Proskynine is the Greek word for worship here, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." And Jesus accepts that. He doesn't demur and say, "Oh, no, don't say that." And of course, you've got in John statements like Thomas, where he says, "My Lord and my God," and Jesus accepts this worship. So the idea seems to me that Jesus has said many times in the Synoptics and by his actions of accepting the worship of his disciples in the Synoptic Gospels, he has indicated his claim to divinity.
The earliest Christians, before the Gospels are in there, are in many cases written. When the earliest Christians are gathering, as the book of Acts tells us, on the Lord's Day, it's a matter of their custom, are these earliest Christians, as far as we can tell, worshiping Jesus as fully divine?
Yes, I think one of the things I point out in the book, there's a very, very powerful evidence. Our oldest Christian documents are the letters of the New Testament. Paul wrote most of them, but there are other authors also. And in these letters, we have ancient hymns and creeds and confessional liturgical formula that Paul did not write and that these other writers did not write, but were in use. And these documents were written, by the way, Paul's letters start at about 48. The crucifixion was 33, so you're talking about within 15 years of the crucifixion. These letters incorporate pre-existing hymns and creeds and liturgical formula, and all of them refer to Jesus as divine. You can take, for example, in the Second Philippians, there's a hymn. It's often set off in a poetic form where it describes Jesus who, though he was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be exploited, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, being born in human likeness. And then at the end of that hymn, every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. And that is a reference to Isaiah 45, where the Lord God, Yahweh, declares, to me every knee shall bow, every tongue shall swear. So the Jews of that time would have realized that they were talking about Jesus as God. And then you have in Colossians a wonderful hymn at 1 Colossians 15, where in the Phillips translations is Christ is the visible expression of the invisible God. He existed before creation began. All creation took place through him, and none took place without him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together, and in him the fullness of God dwelt. And that is actually a hymn, and there are ways in which you can identify these hymns, that they were not written by Paul. They have un-Pauline language in them. The hymn from Philippians, when you translate it back into Aramaic, it rhymes. It has two, three, four beat rhythms, and it has alliteration and assonance. In the Colossians, you have cadences in the Greek, which indicate that this is a hymn. And so it's widely agreed among New Testament scholars that these hymns and creeds and liturgical formula are something that were not written by Paul or Peter, or in Peter's the Petrine formula in Acts, where Peter is talking after talking in Jerusalem. But they all give an indication, or I should say strong statement, that Jesus is divine.
Let's take a break right there, and when we come back, we'll talk more about the earliest Christians' view of Jesus and the case for the divinity of Jesus. Our guest, Dean Overman. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Monday afternoon, December the 21st. You're listening to Issues, Etc. We've got nothing against bumper stickers, just bumper sticker theology. And we'd like to send you the new Issues, Etc. bumper sticker. You'll find the Issues, Etc. logo, slogan, and website address. Simply send your request to Lutheran Public Radio, 1600 Gulfview Drive, Suite 230, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Please include a self-addressed stamped envelope. Good theology doesn't fit on a bumper sticker, but you can tell people where to find good theology, the new Issues, Etc. bumper or window sticker.
Would you like to share something you've heard on Issues, Etc. via email, Facebook, Twitter, or text message? Well, we've made it easy for you. Just go to the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, and click Share This. You'll find almost 50 ways to share Issues, Etc. audio. We love our on-demand listeners. Old Theology, New Technology, issuesetc.org. Go to the on-demand page and click Share This.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
International human rights attorney and law professor Dr. John Warwick Montgomery on the importance of Issues, Etc.
Before settling in England and France, I had my own Christian radio program for 10 years in California and 2 years in Washington State. I was also a regular for over a decade on national religious television. In a word, I have had a great deal of contact with evangelical programming, both good and bad, and my judgment in this area is probably worth something. In my opinion, Issues Etc. is one of the very few programs on Christian radio willing to discuss tough questions with solid theological answers. I consider it a great privilege to be able to appear on the program regularly, and I commend it to every serious listener.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a tax-deductible gift today. Donate online at issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Defending the faith, teaching the truth. Issues Etc.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the deity of Christ. Our guest, Dean Overman. He's author of the new book titled A Case for the Divinity of Jesus, Examining the Earliest Evidence. When you purchase A Case for the Divinity of Jesus using the Amazon.com link, at our website, issuesetc.org. A percentage of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. Issuesetc.org. Click listen and go to the on-demand page. Look for A Case for the Divinity of Jesus by our guest, Dean Overman. Tomorrow on Issues, Etc., we'll respond to objections to the virgin birth. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery will be our guest. So we have not only the earliest practices, creedal formulae, the liturgical texts of the earliest Christians, then these things are also reflected and included in some cases in the earliest New Testament writings, the epistles of Paul and the other apostles. We come to the time of the Gospels. After the apostolic era, does anyone within the pale of Orthodox Christianity seriously question Christ's divinity?
After the apostolic period.
Yes.
Actually, you know, this is another place which we've had a lot of misunderstanding. In the Da Vinci Code, they refer to the Gospel of Thomas and the Gnostic Gospels. And they take the position in the Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown did, that the Gnostics' Gospel of Thomas mainly looks upon Jesus as human and not divine. But it's actually just the opposite. The Gnostics, and including in the Gospel of Thomas, they look upon Jesus as too divine to be human. In other words, they question his humanity. So that in saying 77 in the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus makes a clear statement that he is divine, that he is the all, and for him all the all comes from. And split a piece of wood and I am there. So there has been some misunderstanding that in the second century, all the Gnostic texts, including the Gospel of Thomas, and I have an argument in the book, a very powerful argument that Nicholas Perrin had written, showing that the Gospel of Thomas is, without a doubt, a late second century composition that was written relying on Tatian's Diatessaron, which was written about 172 A.D., and that was a compilation of the four canonical Gospels, and the Gospel of Thomas brought into that a strange, bizarre myth that was part of the Gnosticism of the time. And although Elaine Pagels argues that it should be viewed as a first century document, is actually quite strong evidence in my book where I take Perrin's study and show that it had to be written in the late second century and that it gives us absolutely no independent historical information about the first century or about Jesus of Nazareth. And so that's it's an interesting study in that it's really proved by the use of puns, paronomasia it's called, it's word sounds that give the proof. But it takes a while to explain it, so I'll refer to the book at this point.
You respond to Bart Ehrman, who wrote a book some years back, misquoting Jesus. We actually interviewed him when he came out with this book. You say the title of the book is somewhat misleading. I'll let you explain. And Ehrman's contention is, look, there are all sorts of variants in these texts. You can find them at the bottom of the critical editions of the Greek New Testament. You can find these thousands upon thousands of variants. All Ehrman says evidence that the New Testament, in particular the Gospels, are unreliable eyewitness accounts, if they're even eyewitness accounts at all. How do you respond in general to Ehrman's assertion there?
Well, his two books, Misquoting Jesus, I discuss in the main part of the text, and then in an appendix I discuss his Jesus Interrupted, which came out right when this book was going to print. Basically, Bart Ehrman takes very small variations that every New Testament scholar knows about. Anybody who has studied textual criticism knows that there are some these where there should be A's and some minor variants. But his mentor at Princeton, Bruce Metzger, who was in charge of the New Revised Standard version, which was the Oxford and Cambridge Bible, said that, look, these examples of variants in the manuscripts don't require any alteration in any core belief of the Christian faith. So what you have in Ehrman's presentation is a false dichotomy. He lost his faith, he says, because it was Amalek rather than Abiathar who was high priest in the second chapter of Mark. And if there is in the New Testament documents a minor mistake about somebody's name, giving that as his main reason, as he does, for throwing out the whole gospel, I think the real issue is, did Jesus rise from the dead? And Metzger, who was his mentor, was quite certain that we have about 95% certainty of the text of the New Testament documents, that we have the right text, because we have so many manuscripts to compare any errors. And the errors that Ehrman discusses don't require any alteration. They're very minor mistakes. So I don't know. I mean, you know, it's a rather bizarre position. And I think most people, Craig Evans, for example, who's on the National Advisory Board of National Geographic, who read my manuscript, Craig is just puzzled by Ehrman's position. They both sit on that board because it's a false dichotomy that he sends up. Either everything is absolutely perfect, or the whole faith is wrong, and he throws it out on the basis of the second chapter of Mark having possibly a wrong name in it.
You point out late in your book that the divinity of Jesus, this fact of his divine nature, inevitably raises questions about other religions. You conclude that it is simply illogical to maintain that all religions are essentially the same. All roads lead to God. Make your argument there with a couple of minutes left.
Yes, I would like to conclude, as I say in the book, that all religions lead to the same reality. I'd like to take that position. It's the line of least resistance, but it isn't logically possible. It's not logically possible because many of the religions have contrary views of what happened in history. For example, in Islam, they do not believe that Jesus was crucified. Christians believe that he was crucified. It's an event in history. Either it happened or it didn't happen. They can't both be right. In the resurrection, Christians believe that Jesus was bodily raised from the dead. Jews do not agree with that. Both of them can't be right. It's an event in history. Either it happened or it didn't happen. You have irreconcilable philosophical positions. Buddhism takes the position that there is no self. The self is extraordinarily important in the monotheistic religions. There's frequently this example given that we're all feeling an elephant and we're blind, and some people feel an elephant. And they tell the story about these three men who are blind, and one says, look, feel the trunk, and then says, oh, he's like this, and another feels the tail, and he says, oh, he's like this. And then a Raja, who's up on a balcony, comes out, and he says, no, you're all just got separate parts of the elephant, and you're feeling different things and saying different things about it. But in the world in which we live, we don't have a Raja who can look over all of reality and say that we're just feeling different parts here. So that's a wonderful analogy. It's a cute story, but it breaks down when you look at the way in which the universe exists, and we don't have anybody who can look at all of ultimate reality and tell us that we're only feeling in the trunk of the elephant or the tail of the elephant. So I'd like to take the position that all religions lead to the same ultimate reality, but it's an impossible position to take logically. And so what do we do then? Well, I think that rather than attempting to say we're all saying the same thing. I think the best position is to have a truthful and honest atmosphere of mutual respect, love, and esteem, and explain the foundations of our faith. Sir Norman Anderson, who was an expert in Islamic law and a Christian, had many discussions with Muslims. And the people of the Islamic faith, they know what Christians believe. So to say that we're saying the same thing seems to be disingenuous. Far better to say, why don't you explain to me what your faith means to you, and I will listen and try to understand what you're saying. And then if you allow me to explain what my faith, what Christ means, who Christ is to me, then we could both look at how these different beliefs affect our lives and affect our behavior. And we can begin with some type of discussion that way.
Let's take another break here. When we come back, we've got just about 5 more minutes with Dean Overman on the deity of Christ. Then we'll teach a Sunday school lesson with Deaconess Pam Nielsen. As we approach the celebration of Christ's birth, we'll talk about the birth of Jesus. Stay tuned.
Thanks to God's gift of the Internet, people are listening to Issues Etc. around the world.
Hi, this is Ville calling from Finland. I believe the day will come when you cannot enter the office as a pastor in the ELCA unless you subscribe to the ordination of gays and lesbians. And why do I believe that? Because Americans are sinners like we Finns are.
Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. IssuesETC.org.
Thanks for sending us your email. Having produced Issues Etc. for more than 15 years, I can tell you that we've never received email response like this. Unfortunately, we simply can't reply to all of your email. So here's a way that I can almost guarantee a response to your question or comment. Call the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8384. It's available for your questions or comments 24/7, 618-223-8384.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
It's become part of Christmas tradition, the debate over whether or not to even use the word Christmas. Those who want to sterilize Christ out of Christmas say we must be inclusive. But kicking the baby in the manger to the curb isn't inclusive at all. It rips the heart out of Christmas. If you're one of those who feels happy holidays are fighting words, take heart this Christmas because we're celebrating life, eternal life because of the baby Jesus. We also celebrate every time a woman says no to abortion and yes to life. Deuteronomy 30:19 says, I have set before you life and death. Now choose life so you and your children may live. And one more thing, have a Merry Christmas. And make sure you wish everyone else a Merry Christmas, too.
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org. And stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. A few more minutes with Dean Overman, author of the new book, A Case for the Divinity of Jesus, Examining the Earliest Evidence. Then we'll teach a Sunday school lesson with Deaconess Pam Nielsen, as we usually do on Mondays here on Issues Etc. Dean, you say that the resurrection of Jesus is a plausible event, and of course, St. Paul is quick to say that this is really the truth claim that is kind of the key of falsifying all of Christianity. If Christ is not raised, none of the rest of it is worth considering as a truth claim. With only about a minute and a half here, a little bit more, make the case for this central truth claim that is so intimately connected to the divinity of Jesus himself.
Yes, the earliest church was centered about the resurrection. The crucifixion was important, of course, as an atoning sacrifice, but the center of the faith was the resurrection. I think that when you examine the evidence surrounding the belief of the mother congregation, which we have recorded in these hymns and creeds, which were incorporated in our earliest Christian documents, that is, the letters of the New Testament, you see that the that the eyewitnesses, that is, the mother congregation in Jerusalem, where Peter and James and John worshipped, you can see in the Aramaic hymns that there was this reference to Jesus as divine. Now, this is absolutely astounding because these people were Jews. They were extraordinarily fearful of punishment similar to Jesus's. They ran away and hid. And yet, within a few weeks of the crucifixion, we find them in the streets of Jerusalem proclaiming the resurrection of Jesus. They are subsequently flogged and told not to speak in the name of Jesus. And flogging was a very painful experience. People could die from it. It wasn't just a whipping. And yet they go right back out in the street and do it again. So they clearly believe, this mother congregation, in the resurrection of Jesus. You see this tremendous change in the disciples. And then you see the birth of the church. And it requires an explanation. What happened that all of a sudden, like a volcano erupting, you have this proclamation of Jesus as Lord? The central foundation appears to be based on two very strong convictions. One is that Jesus' tomb was empty. It probably was the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. He was an actual member of the Jewish Sanhedrin. It would have been very unlikely that they would make up a fictitious name because that could have been disputed. But we have no record of anyone disputing that it was Joseph of Arimathea and that he was a member of the Jewish Sanhedrin, which is a well-known body. The existence of a hostile polemic, that is, an assertion that the disciples had stolen the body of Jesus, is an indication that the tomb was empty. They could have stopped the whole Christian movement just by producing the body of Jesus. And if this was a creation of fiction, you would have to ask, why were women used as witnesses by these disciples to say that these women had come back with the story of the empty tomb? Women had no legal status as witnesses in first century Judaism, so if you were creating a fiction about this, you certainly wouldn't put in women. The idea that Jesus didn't die, but he revived in the tomb, that is, I think most people think that that's not feasible, because how could he look like the Lord of the universe if he was wounded and crippled and barely able to stand up? Then you have this statement in the earliest creed that we have, which is in 1 Corinthians 15, which talks about Christ was died, he was buried, and rose again, and he appeared to Cephas. That's the Aramaic name for Peter. So this is a very, very early creed. Goes back to within a couple years. Paul didn't write it. He incorporates it into 1 Corinthians 15. And the appearances then are to about 500 people. And as you look at the appearances throughout the gospel accounts, they couldn't have been hallucinations. There were too many of them in too many different situations. And if the disciples had any doubt whatsoever about whether or not they had seen Jesus, they certainly wouldn't have gone through another flogging or run the risk of crucifixion. So something turned these men around in an extraordinarily powerful way. And I think that the simplest and therefore the best explanation is that the appearances of Jesus were real. And clearly these men believed that they were real, because I don't know about you, but if somebody's about to pound a nail into my hand, or if I'd actually been flogged, which is what happened to these men as they appeared before the Jewish council, and were told not to speak in the name of Jesus, and they went right out and did it again, the idea that they were not convinced. There's a Jewish rabbi, Pincus Lapid.
About 30 seconds here.
Pincus Lapid, who looked at this as a Jewish New Testament scholar, and he came up with the conclusion, and I use quite a bit of his discussion in my book, that the only rational explanation for the founding of the church was Jesus' resurrection. He didn't accept Jesus as the Messiah, although people think maybe he actually did before he died. But so I think that the simplest and best view of the evidence is that the appearance of Jesus was real, the tomb was empty, and the church was born. Otherwise, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Dean Overman is former senior partner of an international law firm. He was selected as the Templeton Scholar for Seminars in Religion and Science. He's author of the new book titled A Case for the Divinity of Jesus, Examining the Earliest Evidence. You can purchase A Case for the Divinity of Jesus at our website, issuesetc.org. Dean, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you, and have a Merry Christmas.
And you.